Good morning, good evening, hello, wherever you are. Welcome back to the AirPod. I'm your host, Omid Scobie, joined by my co-host, Maggie Rooley, for the latest catch-up on all things royal this week, with a pretty sort of environmentally focused episode this week, Mags.
It is. Hi, Omid. You know, that beginning reminded me of The Truman Show, one of my favorite scenes, where he starts off and he's like, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and if I don't see you, good night. I like that I just referenced a movie from like 20 years ago to start this podcast. I immediately apologize to everyone. But you know, when you see a reference, you gotta just go for it, Omid.
You gotta go with it. It's been a busy one this week. We had the launch, or I guess the sort of second part of the launch of Prince William's Earthshot Prize, which we're going to get into very shortly, as well as a deeper dive into the world of the royal family and conservation, because I feel like it's something that more than a few members of the family seem to really champion. We'll also be catching up with the Duchess of Cambridge, who visited students in the UK this week affected by the global pandemic, and elsewhere in the world of royalty, we'll be catching up with the Sussexes as they prepare to mark the International Day of the Girl. Harry surprised marathon runners in LA, and the Queen surprisingly thanked the British press.
Surprise! Yeah, that was a good curveball this week.
For providing reliable sources of information amid the pandemic. Now, it is important to clarify that this is about a particularly important moment in time and not necessarily about the press in general. But it was interesting to see the Queen really sort of make that acknowledgement to
the press. I feel like
press,
she was speaking right been... to me, Omid.
She was really talking about your work.
Thank you so much, Queen, for recognizing all that I do.
This was actually marking Journalism Matters Week for this year, and she had sent a message over in light of the COVID-19 pandemic, saying that it demonstrated once again the important public service that the established news media provides both nationally and regionally. She acknowledged that the world and the media landscape has changed dramatically, particularly when it comes to trusted, reliable sources of information, but went on to thank those that had become sources of vital information, particularly during these difficult times. And I think this really has been a moment in our lives where I think so many have relied on wherever it is that they get their information from to sort of accurately inform them on where we're at. Particularly confusing time, I would say.
Yeah, and all jokes aside, it was really nice of her to recognize that group during a week, you know, where we are recognizing journalists around the world. I did find it really interesting, though, that she did put that fairly, you know, large caveat in there of established British media, which, you know, in today's day and age, is important to remember of a media education as well. And so, you know, I think it's interesting that she definitely made a point to say thank you to the certain people. You know who you are.
Exactly. And thank you next to all gossip and clickbait. Now, we did have big news from Prince William this week, launching his most ambitious project to date. We had new details of the Earthshot Prize, which was announced in December last year, but the information that came this week that it is now a $65 million prize attached to this initiative. Now, the money will actually be split up into 10 different award ceremonies over the next 10 years, so between now and 2030. And each year we'll see five individuals or organizations or science labs, or anyone who has really contributed a substantially impactful solution to a number of our global environmental challenges. And there are five very specific categories for that. Maggie, I think you've got them there.
Yeah, the five that they outlined as ways to really actually help the world were protect and restore nature, clean our air, revive our oceans, build a waste-free world, and fix our climate. So these are big, ambitious goals, and they want to do it in 10 years. But the two big things that I loved about this, Omid, that really stuck out is, William made the point to say, and which is true, when we talk about climate change, there's often so much negativity associated with it because, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a very serious, often negative thing. We see what's happening to our climate, to our world right now. It is scary, it's emotional, and so much of it seems lost, like we can't do anything. So he made the point that he wants these Earthshot prizes to be all about positivity and sort of the other side of the coin, not about, all of the horrible things that are happening, but instead all of the amazing things that are happening to try to save the planet. And so I loved that shift of focus that, we're going to focus on these big ideas that could actually change the world in these five main categories and focus on people that are doing some really incredible things all over the world too. They really made a point to stress the diversity and the global aspect of this, that they're going to try to make sure that, all of the continents are represented, all sorts of people are represented, and they're just going to find the best ideas wherever they are.
And they, of course, the mission here is that by the end of this, by the end of 2030, we'll have 50 practical solutions that will contribute to repairing our planet, and of course the many environmental issues that we're currently dealing with at the moment. And you speak about it being very global. They also announced a prize council that will help pull together those five finalists each year. And they went into great detail about exactly what the process will be. But I think most interestingly to everyone were the names that have been attached into it. And beyond sort of Prince William and Sir David Attenborough, who we already knew was part of this project, they announced 11 other names, which included Shakira, Kate Blanchett, Queen Rania of Jordan, and Yao Ming, the legendary basketball player.
It was
It's
a
a
lot.
long
Yeah,
list.
it's an interesting group of people.
Yeah, it covers six different continents. So we're looking at sort of Brazilian soccer star Dani Alves, the Costa Rican diplomat Cristiana Figueres, former PepsiCo CEO Indra Nooyi. It goes on. And of course, we've got Chinese business magnate Jack Ma on the list too. So it's a really diverse list. And I think what's important about this, it shows just how wide-reaching they want this event to be. This will take place in a different city every year. The first year, next fall, will be in London, but beyond that, it could be anywhere across the six continents that are represented in this initiative. And I think it's a really, listen, it's ambitious. There are certainly no shortage of environmental prizes in our world, and we've heard other environmentalists such as Greta Thunberg talk about the just sort of overwhelming amount that we have, and why some eco-advocates aren't actually involved in things like this at the moment. But I think what's important about this is that this is really something that's going to be available to anyone to be a part of. So when we do talk about those that can bring that change, we're not just talking about researchers and scientists. This could be from a scientific team in Norway to a 12-year-old in a classroom in Kenya. So it really opens it up to everyone. But of course, there is a process to get to that prize council. There'll also be a global alliance of partners that include Greenpeace, WWF, the UN Environment Programme, TED Countdown, a really long list. And each of these will submit their selections to a panel of international experts who then make their recommendations to the prize council of the names that we just discussed, who will then pick those five winners. There's a lot to unpack, but I think what's exciting about this is that it's happening. We've been talking about it for a while, and what was interesting to hear some of the backstory about it. Kensington Palace actually brought all of the press together, including ABC News, for a media briefing to just sort of tell us exactly how this had come about. And Maggie, you and I were talking last week about the A Planet for Us All documentary that William had contributed to. And it was during that documentary we see him visiting Namibia, Kenya, and Tanzania to tackle some of the illegal wildlife trade and conservation issues that take over there. There's a very powerful scene where he's seeing a sort of mountain of elephant tusks or rhino tusks that had been confiscated by authorities, and William clearly very emotional by that. We sort of saw just how emotional a trip it was for him. And the palace say that it was actually during this trip that was when the ideas, or the first ideas, started swirling in his head about creating at least a bigger conversation about the global environmental challenges that we face and finding solutions for them. And so when he came back to the UK, and this is sort of late 2018, he met up with Sir David Attenborough to discuss what is now, of course, the Earthshot Prize. So it's been in development for a while, and you know, we're now seeing the fruits of that labor.
Well, I do love that sort of the energy behind this prize, because it seems like they really want to make the people that win this celebrities in their own right. They want to create this buzz and this energy around environmentalism and conservationism, where, you know, these are people that should be treated almost like sports stars, and they are doing things to really save our planet. And so by, one, giving them a lot of money that has to be used towards their project, we should say, and also sort of creating this, you can't just go do whatever you want with the million, but giving them money for their project, and then also, you know, really treating them like stars and taking these people seriously and giving them energy and buzz. It's really exciting. And, you know, one other thing that I really loved out of all of this, Sir David Attenborough, who we've mentioned, is on the prize council as well. He was asked about, well, what kind of ideas are we looking for, right? Like, how science-y does it have to be? And he responded saying something along the lines of, you know, even if it's a crackpot idea, we want it. Meaning, like, he wants all the crazy ideas, the things that might not seem like they're ever going to work. They really want to hear from people that might be ignored otherwise. They want the ideas that seem outlandish and outside the box, because, you know, often sometimes those are the ones that really make a difference. And so if this is a place where those kind of ideas are celebrated and encouraged, it could be really exciting.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's prizes like this that really are the catalyst for change that is needed at times like this. And I think it's important that, you know, as you pointed out, to create this sort of celebratory moment about the individuals that are being recognized at these annual ceremonies, to turn them into household names as such, because actually we're in an age where it is having that platform that really allows the change to happen. It's not necessarily the solution itself, but it has to come hand in hand with that sort of soapbox to actually stand on and share it with the world. And William actually spoke about his optimism and this sort of need for a catalyst during a chat with BBC Radio 4's Today Show earlier this week, where he said that the urgency with optimism really creates action.
I do feel that you have to have the urgency and the importance of what's going to happen and the seriousness of what is coming along. And there are plenty of people talking about that. But I personally feel, and I think a lot of the council of the prize feel, that we must have some hope, we must have some optimism, because if we don't, it is all too much. It is very apocalyptic about things. And I think, you know, these are grave times for the environment, but I do believe with human ingenuity, and I do believe with younger generations speaking up like they are now, that they will not stand for this lack of hope, this lack of idea that we can't fix some of these big solutions.
Now, the first ceremony isn't taking place until next year, but the nominations for the first Earthshot actually begin from November the 1st. There'll be over 100 nominating partners invited to cast their entries, very much in the same way that the Nobel Peace Prize works. And in fact, there have been comparisons made to this initiative to the Nobel, or calling it the sort of Green Nobel, of the sort of environmental space. And that just sort of shows the aspirations that have come with a project like this. It'll be very interesting to see if we see or hear from other members of the royal family getting involved. In fact, that was one of the questions most asked during the recent media briefing, was that will we see the Queen acknowledge this?
What was the answer?
And the answer was watch this space. So I'd imagine that is a soft yes, in the way that the palace usually comes as close to a yes as they can get.
Well, I'm really excited to see what kind of initiatives and projects people come up with. I mean, I love when people are kind of pushed to see past their boundaries and come up with creative things. So it could be really cool.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of other members of the royal family, Prince William is not the only environmental advocate within the firm. And we'll be having a little chat about the world of the royals and eco-advocacy after the break. Welcome back. Maggie, we were talking just before the break about how other members of the royal family are just as involved in environmental issues. And it's interesting that now we sort of reach this point where we kind of see we've got Prince Charles, Prince William, mm-hmm. and Prince Harry all launching a sort of landmark environmentalist initiatives at almost the same time. But it's clear that each one has sort of got a slightly different aim.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I think this is such a big space and such a big, important topic that touches upon really so many problems and issues we're facing today that in a way it seems like they might crowd each other. But, you know, there are plenty of issues out there to focus on. And so it's kind of cool that they're all under the same big umbrella, but choosing a very specific lane to focus on.
Prince William spoke about how much his father and his grandfather had inspired him to really sort of go down this route. And he hopes that he'll become that sort of same inspiration to Prince George, Louis and Princess Charlotte when they become of age. But it's interesting to look back at just some of the impact that members of the royal family have had within the environmental space. Prince Charles is a president of WWF UK, and Prince Philip was also a president and co-founder before him. In fact, Prince Charles set up the Prince's Rainforest Group in 2007 to find practical solutions to slow tropical deforestation, combat climate change. We've seen him speak at the UN Climate Summit more than one occasion, and more recently giving that keynote speech to the Oslo Climate and Forest Conference. So Charles has really probably had the biggest impact within this space. I think he's been certainly the most outspoken, and I think he himself has referred to the fact that he's been talking about it since it long became a cool issue to discuss. I think he was really one of the first I think public figures in this country to talk about wasted plastic, and this is sort of going back to the late 70s, at a time when plastic was probably being used for absolutely everything with abandon and with no thought behind it. And of course, we've now seen that effort that he makes sort of carry across all of the royal households as well. He's put a plastic ban on all offices that are related to him. I think it's a paperless office at Clarence House. No one is allowed to print or do anything that could be considered wasteful. And it sounds a little extreme, but I think it's that case of leading by example. And you can see how far it carries along then across the other royal households and even within sort of royal workspaces.
Well, I think it's such an interesting point you make. I know William sort of poked fun at that even, that, you know, his dad's been doing this before it was cool, and I hope that my son can look back at me and know that I was, you know, also taking these issues seriously and sort of passing on to the next generation. And what's been great about watching sort of all of the members of the royal family work in the same avenue is, you know, you mentioned Charles been working on this since well before even the 70s, you know, quite really his whole life, really. And even now, though, he's still looking towards the future. It's not something that he's, you know, given up on or lost enthusiasm for. Right now, you mentioned those keynote speeches he's been giving, and he's been a big proponent of this thing called the Great Reset, where to take a moment to look as we're hopefully coming out of this pandemic and changed people, and using this moment to reset and how we look at the future. And he's made the point to say we shouldn't just be investing in, you know, the economy's going forward, but also making sure we're investing in conservation and the environment, and that all those things are really linked. And he even put the threat out there recently that what we're going to see from climate change will overshadow anything we've seen from this pandemic. So it's something clearly that he still takes so seriously. His enthusiasm is not fading. And if anything, it just seems to be becoming something that's more and more important to him over time.
And it's great to see how much that he has inspired his own children. I think, you know, Prince Harry and his work on the Travelist initiative is something that, you know, there's still so much more for us to see from that. But, you know, it's already been announced, this sort of bold global initiative that he found alongside Booking.com and Skyscanner and Trip.com, TripAdvisor and so on. To really sort of like restructure the tourism industry and create ways in which travelers can think about how they move around the world and do it in a sort of in a slightly less disruptive and more impactful way or more positively impactful. Yeah.
Talking about the great, you know, reset that Charles is putting forth. I mean, what a time for Travelist after so many people have stopped travel and are looking to start up traveling. And I think people want to do it in sort of a smarter, more eco-friendly way. So, you know, I know Travelist has sort of been put on pause a bit because of the pandemic, but I think that when people start traveling again, it'll be more important now than ever.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that Harry himself has said, that, you know, this pandemic has really pushed everyone back to sort of rethink about how they introduce Travelist to the world. And it's put them in this really important moment, a pivotal moment, I would say, for the tourism industry to actually bring that change in at a time when I think everyone is extremely open to it. You know, Harry's idea for Travelist started a long time ago during some of his early visits to Botswana. And, you know, it's somewhere that he's traveled to every year. And he himself found that whilst the tourism industry for that area was certainly getting bigger, and the travel operators and the sort of excursions that were available were getting sort of bigger and more luxurious, he found that the communities within Botswana were actually relatively the same as when he had first started visiting there. And so that's really one of the big focuses of Travelist, is ensuring that the communities that tourists and travelers visiting actually benefit from that business, and it's not just sort of existing with within a separate ecosystem. And ultimately that then feeds back into the environment and the surroundings of those communities, because then the money goes beyond sort of making the lives of the people within those communities better, but also the surroundings, and more focus can go on those things. That I think that in certainly in more developed countries, we have that benefit, that luxury to think about doing things in a slightly less or slightly more eco-conscious way. But that's not a thought that can be shared universally until everyone is sort of on a more sort of even playing field.
Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to see how all these initiatives play out over the next few years. And you know, the exciting thing is that there's such enthusiasm and backing behind it. It sounds like, you know, across the royal family. And I'm curious, Omid, your thoughts. Do you think that they'll all sort of work together on these separate initiatives? You know, each of them obviously has, as we've said, their own path, but they are all sort of interrelated. Do you think they'll support each other in these endeavors?
It's interesting. I mean, we certainly have seen them. We've certainly seen William and his father join forces in the past. I mean, I think it was must have been 6 or 7 years ago now, Charles and William hosted a summit of international law enforcement and wildlife groups. And this was their sort of war on poachers. And this was to tackle the $15 billion, or at the time, the $15 billion illegal trade industry that sort of existed and thrived, unfortunately, off of endangering wildlife. And that's something that Williams continued to do, obviously, as patron of the Tusk Trust. That was something that we saw him touch on within the A Planet for Us All documentary that recently aired. And Charles himself has spoken about how he wants to inspire his grandchildren to sort of pick up the baton one day from their fathers and their grandfather to do that same work. But at the same time, I do think that there perhaps might be a little competitiveness within the space too. It's something, you know, usually we see members of the royal family focus on very unique issues or causes to them, and that sort of becomes their space within that sort of philanthropic landscape. And the environment and climate change and eco issues are the one thing that we've seen shared by a number of members of the royal family always at one time. So it's making sure that all of them have that space to exist within that. And I you know, understand that there were times in the past that Harry certainly felt frustrated being slightly lower down on the sort of running order, that he wouldn't necessarily be a priority when it came to launching such initiatives such as Earthshot Prize. You know, I would imagine that's something that Harry is now capable of doing, being independent for the royal family. But within the royal family, this is the sort of big ticket item that the future heir to the throne will get, not someone that's sixth in the line.
Oh, that is really interesting. But at the end of the day, I'm happy that at least they're all trying to find their own, because like we said, this is such a huge issue. There's plenty of help that is needed. And so, I mean, on one hand, the more the merrier.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it hasn't all been about one Cambridge this week. We saw the Duchess of Cambridge go back to school this week in a slightly different way. It was for a public engagement, but one that saw her visiting the University of Derby to speak with students about how their mental health has been impacted amid the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Because, of course, university students up and down the country have been back at their halls of residence and on their campuses, but it's been a really challenging time for them. As we've seen, there are many students in universities across the country who are stuck within their accommodation in self-isolation, and it's been a particularly difficult time.
Yeah, you know, pandemic was so tough on so many people, but the stats show that young people were really suffering from depression and anxiety under lockdown, and going back to university and college was great, but like you mentioned, the UK in particular is having a huge problem with people now having to quarantine or isolate on campus, and it can be very stressful and scary, and this is all happening during formative years of your life. So I thought it was really cool that Kate went back to talk to these people who I think are often overlooked. You know, people think, oh, you're fine, you're 19, you should be excited, you're at school. But you have to remember what it was like to be, you know, 19 at university. Those are actually pretty stressful times. Then you add in a pandemic on top of it. So I think it was great that she made the point to go to these students, to talk with them, to take their issues seriously, to make sure they feel like someone is listening to them. I also loved, just this is a total fluffy side note, but I loved all the headlines of like Kate on campus, because she is so good at it. I mean, she looks like she could still be a college student, so I feel like she like fit right in.
You know, I feel for university students at this time, because imagine going off to college. It's your first year. I loved university. I just had such a blast from day one. And to do that socially isolated, I just can't imagine anything worse.
Yeah. No, it's true. And I think that's why now more than ever, it was great to sort of pay attention to those people and let them know, like, we get it. This really is not a good situation, and we're all sorry for you.
Yeah, this visit comes ahead of World Mental Health Day, which is this weekend, actually. And so it was a chance for Kate to not only speak with those first-year students, who probably are finding this all very surreal, but also speaking with nursing students about the effects that the pandemic's had on them and their schoolwork, you know, whether it's changed the body of work that they're studying. Of course, this is something that's relatively new in our conversation, but what I'd imagine will have an impact on the curriculum, particularly for students within that space.
Well, that's really interesting. Talking to the people that are sort of the next essential frontline workers as they're training, and they know what they're getting into, and they're still there training to do it. It's actually pretty incredible.
Exactly. Well, straight after World Mental Health Day is International Day of the Girl on October the 11th, which Harry and Meghan will be acknowledging or marking in a way that I think we've gotten pretty used to by now, via virtual chat with the global icon Malala Yousafzai. Now, this will be done in partnership with the Malala Fund, which is an organisation that takes a look at the unique challenges that women and girls around the world face when it comes to accessing education. And this conversation will not only look at that, but also how the pandemic has affected the situation. The press statement says that their conversation looks at the COVID-19's disproportionate impact on young women's access to education and how everyone can all contribute to a more equal future for girls, as well as the value of education in their own lives. So very, very much up Harry and Meghan's street. This is an area of particular importance to Meghan, who's really sort of focused on equal education opportunities since long before she even became a member of the royal family. And you know, it's great to see them back in this space. It's been a relatively quiet week for them, actually. I feel like they have dominated the headlines for the past, I don't know how many episodes
they needed a break
of this podcast that we've done. I think we can forgive them for taking a back seat for once.
Yeah, exactly. But it is interesting, though, you know, I appreciate this year that they're speaking to what's happening in the world. And, you know, it's not just education for young women that's really been hit hard during this pandemic, but even in places like the UK and the US, women have been disproportionately affected with employment opportunities during the pandemic. pandemic, and you know, more young women are unemployed, they have greater rates of unemployment right now. More young women are also, you know, bearing the brunt of more childcare and stepping back from their careers. And so I think it's a really interesting time to be talking about this, and really important that they're still shining the light on this issue. You know, clearly there's so much happening right now and there are so many important issues, but the fact that this has always been important to them, that they're still focusing on it and making it relevant to today, I think is so important.
Yeah. And as you say, the numbers really highlight how grave an issue this is. You know, the latest figure showed there are over 130 million girls around the world who are out of school, which, you know, is a serious crisis. And, you know, I think with the pandemic, it will only make that more difficult. So I think it will be a really interesting conversation. We'll have highlights from that in the next episode. But before we do go, I want to share a little moment of the week.
Oh, this was so many. This is my favorite thing that happened all week, Omid.
This happened just after we finished the last episode, actually. David Attenborough recently, if you don't follow him on Instagram, go and follow him now. He recently launched his own Instagram channel, and he, alongside it, launched his own Ask David series. So celebrities, public figures, politicians around the world can send in any questions that they have. And first on the list were the Cambridge children, Charlotte, Louis and George, who all had something to say.
Hello, David Attenborough. What animal do you think will become extinct next?
Hello, David Attenborough. I like spiders. Do you like spiders too?
What animal do you like?
Omid, come on. Is that not the cutest thing you've ever heard? I was just like in love with these children when they were asking him questions, because they're so earnest. They take it so seriously too, but they have these cute, well, as an American, I find their accents adorable, obviously. So they have these like cute little accents, and they're asking, you know, David Attenborough all these really important grown-up questions. I'm sorry, we just don't really get to hear from them ever or see them all that much. And so seeing them like this, just my heart.
I think my weak spot is children that can't pronounce things properly. I don't know why, but if I'm in a bad mood, that will certainly lift my spirits. But you know what surprised me about this was that, I don't know if it was as noticeable to you or not, but their accents are relatively sort of everyday British children's accents. I was expecting
something
a little plummier from the Cambridge children.
Did it make you appreciate their accents then?
You know, I was just surprised. It was somewhat refreshing in a way, because we've heard royal children speak in the past, and you know, it often sounds very different. But I think that speaks to a lot about the fact that the kids are being educated in schools in London. Mm-hmm. They're incredibly diverse, and I think that despite their opulent surroundings, they are growing up in somewhat or as close to normal an environment as they can.
Well, I, for one, vote for more cute Instagram videos from them.
All right. I'll see what I can do.
If anyone cares, yeah, see what you can do.
Well, thanks again, everyone, for tuning into the show this week. Thanks for all the tweets as well. Do keep them coming in. Send them to myself at Scobie on Twitter or at Maggie Woolley on the same platform. Just use the hashtag TheAirPod to stay in touch with us and so we can find you. Until the next episode, Maggie, thank you again.
Always a pleasure. See you later, Omid.
Take care.